Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Lob podcast from These Football Times, and we've got a special edition today. You come to the end of the season, and quite often you'll lose a player or two, or a manager will leave, or something will go on. It's not often that you have to say farewell to your home, to your ground, which of course is what's facing Everton in the coming couple of weeks. So we can't miss this opportunity to get to talk to Paul McParland about all these millions of memories of Goodison Park over the years. So good evening, Paul.
Good evening, Dave, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to kind of look back at my experiences at Goodison Park, a stadium I've attended for more years than I care to remember. But yeah, it is quite a historic day, you know, in the life of the football club, and in my life as well. I'm, you know, particularly for Evertonians of my generation who've kind of been going there, you know, for over 5-6 decades, and I've got so many memories associated with the stadium. And I think there's still a feeling amongst a number of us that, you know, it's not really going to happen, is it? You know, we're going to turn up as per routine in August and stand outside Goodison Park and wonder why there's not a game going on there.
I suppose the best place to start is at the beginning, and your first games going to Goodison Park and your first impressions of the place when you were a youth.
Probably give you a three-part answer to this, Dave, right? Because I think my first game might have been in the 60-61 season when I was about 5, but I don't remember anything about it apart from the fact I've got this lingering memory that I saw Everton play Chelsea. I remember the score was 1-1. And it's one of these things where we talked about with Stephen a few times about asking your parents things while they're still here. And I just really regret I never checked with that. Did I actually go to that game, Dad? Because I've got this memory here somewhere that was there. But apart from the score, and in fact, Chelsea wearing red shirts, I can't remember that much about it. So first real memory would be the 62-63 season. And there's kind of two answers to this. 62-63, I've been to my first Everton game away at Blackburn in the November. And I wanted to go to a home game, but one of my friends wanted to come to a home game as well. So my dad was quite happy to pay for me to go to the ground, but couldn't quite afford to pay for the two of us. So he suggested we went in the boys' pen, which didn't turn out quite the way we expected. It was quite a grim experience, which I'll come back to a little bit later if you wish. But it ended up with me and my friend, I think Alan, left after 10 minutes, penniless. All our sweets had been stolen. Our hair had been pulled everywhere. Our clothes were ripped, and we came out crying our eyes out and stood outside the ground for the next 80 minutes waiting for the match to end so I could be sort of my dad again. So didn't miss much, actually. It was Everton 0, Wolves 0. But my first game that I do really remember, I don't quite know how I ended up going to this one, but it was towards the end of the 62-63 season. It was Everton's second last home game of the season against Bolton Wanderers when we were going with the Champions that season and needed to win as many games at home as possible to keep our hopes alive. I don't know why, but something, my dad took me to that game. He took me in the stands for that game, so I had to be in about 6 or 7, something like that. And we beat Bolton Wanderers 1-0. But because I've been to an Everton away game, I had some idea of what to expect from a football stadium. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, you go up those steps into the stand, you get your seat, and you just look out at the playing area, the vastness of the arena, all the crowd. You're mesmerised by the faces, the characters, and then the noise when the team comes out. It's almost eardrum splitting level. And then the fervour, and then discovering a whole new vocabulary of swear words I'd never heard in the playgrounds at all. It was a real eye-opener on every level. But from the moment the game starts, you know, no matter how old or young you are, you're just wrapped up with the game. You get involved the most. And of course, you take your leave from your parents. So I'm watching my dad, what are his reactions? Well, I need to do this. You know, if he boos, I need to boo, that type of thing. So yeah, it was just an absolutely, you know, fabulous experience. And I'm sure, you know, people listening to this have got their own personal memories of their first game. And some may, like me, have them a bit confused about what actually was the first game with the passage of time. But yeah, you can't. Going to your first proper football match for the full 90 minutes is an experience that, you know, that kind of stays with you. And I'm just so thankful that I think my dad took the wise decision to he bought me tickets for the stand that day, so I was actually sitting down because everything I'd be in the glass trees in like 55,000 plus, I really wouldn't have seen the thing. It would have been like the boy's pen again. So I'm kind of eternally grateful for him that he was prepared to dispatch out a bit of money to make it a far more memorable and enjoyable day for me. And Everton won 1-0. I think it might have been Roy Verdon who scored. And the Fulham home game after that, we'd be Fulham 4-1 to win the league title.
Not a bad place to start. Going back to people of our vintage, so we say, you didn't see football on television in the same way that you do. I mean, it's there all the time now. You can't avoid football on television. And if you did see it on telly, it was in black and white. And to actually go into a stadium in the colour and the grass was there and all that, I mean, it was an overwhelming thing, wasn't it?
I was one of these sad footballing people who spent my whole life collecting picture cards, collecting programmes, reading all the match reports, getting all the magazines like Soccer Star, Charles Buchan's Football Monthly. I've devoured all of these things. So I always had this mental image in my mind of what these players would be like when you saw them. But you're right, Dave, when you actually went there for the first time and saw them in the flesh, in colour rather than monochrome, because even the page were monochrome then, weren't they? There weren't any colour pictures as such. And it's just, I remember how resplendent the royal blue jerseys look, how just stood out the contrast in the background. And there's just something about seeing something live, experiencing it rather than being a degree removed. So much of TV these days is, you know, the game might be on the TV, but, you know, you think nothing of going out to go to the tournament, make yourself a cup of tea, come back. You know, you can pause the action and go back to it. And it's just not the same as being there live. And I think as well, at that time, people didn't get up routinely every 5 minutes like they do now to go and get a burger, go and get a pizza, go and get a hot dog. People sat in the seats the whole way through. If you were standing, you didn't move because you'd lose your spec. You couldn't afford someone else to take that vital space you'd got for yourself that you might have queued for 90 minutes before the game to get in to get that space. So people were much more less mobile. And because of that, we're much more involved in the game. Memory serves me correctly as well. Half times, then we're in 10 minutes, not 15 minutes. And so you didn't, if you want to move half time, you couldn't do that because by the time you got down the gangway, the second half was starting again. So, yeah, it was a whole different experience. But you're right, Dave, it was the transition from reading about it in black and white, seeing the football magazines in black and white, to actually being there and seeing it all in colour, seeing the scarf, seeing the rosette, seeing the memorabilia, and even kind of outside the ground, because I was always madly interested in football programmes. On Goodison Road, there were three or four different programme shops, so before the game, I could just spend like an hour in there going through all the different programmes, trying to buy. So it's just a real shame that kind of has also disappeared from the football experience as well.
Goodison Park itself, it's a very idiosyncratic ground. It doesn't look like any other football ground, you know. You know, you can have your arguments about modern build stadiums and whether they all look a bit like they've come from Legoland or whatever. But Goodison Park, you know where you are when you look at Goodison Park. I mean, what were your first impressions walking around the stands and seeing all the various elements to it?
Well, I think the first impression was because at the time when I first started going, I was kind of living on one of the new Greenfield estates kind of on the outer suburbs of Liverpool. So I didn't have much experience with inner city Liverpool. So the first thing that kind of strikes you is when you're walking towards the ground, how cramped and narrow the roads were, all the terrace streets as well, people sitting outside the houses. It sort of wasn't quite used to. And then as you're walking up to the stadium, the first thing that struck me was, why is there a church by this football stadium? No one told me there's a church here, but what's it doing? Surely they can't be having mass today when the game's on. And I remember just lingering outside of St. Luke's Church thinking, well, this is pretty unique, isn't it? You know, having a church outside the ground, and of course that church is still there today. And it's still one that you mentioned about how memorable and unique in many ways Goodison Park is. The fact they've still got a church outside the stadium in the corner makes it absolutely so different to any other compatible stadium in England. And it's just walking around the ground. First thing that kind of hit you was the queues, massive queues outside the turnstiles, people fumbling around for the cash to get in, people queuing to get in. And from when I was a youngster, and I'm sure I wasn't alone in this as well, the pre-match experience is quite different in many ways to what the modern day experience is, because quite often my dad, we'd get the bus from the top from our estate, the 52, which takes about 20, 25 minutes to get to the bus stop by Goodison Park. And then, of course, even with the LSA about 20 past two, my dad in Eversbury always wanted to go for a pre-match drink. So he would go to one of the local hostelries on County Road where he'd meet up with all his friends. And I'd be shoved outside with a bottle of pop and a bag of crisps waiting for them to come out. But for me, this is great because there were always four or five similar urchins like me all sitting outside, guzzling your pop, eating your crisps, talking amongst each other about, you know, do you come here often? Are you here every week? That type of thing. And every now and again, the door would open to the pub and you'd look in, you see this cloud of smoke and all these people there, all wearing suits, which they wore when I first got started into football games. And about 10 to 3, there was kind of like a mass exodus, the door swung open, my dad would grab me, I'm off to the game now. And inevitably, we'd get in there about 1 minute to three, if we were lucky. And my dad had quite a good trick at the time, was that because the Gladys Street terraces was kind of split into a lower section, upper section, there was a bar right in the front of the upper section. So he generally, we fight our way in, and he shoved me in front of the bar, told me to hang on for dear life, that he'd go around and stand behind. So I used to have a good viewpoint for most games, but I couldn't afford to celebrate with both arms because I would have fallen off back into the crowd.
Yes, how very different life is nowadays. within the ground as well, I mean, you know, we're talking just before about the Archibald Leach, you know, built stand and all that kind of stuff. And that again, is one of those great features of English football, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, we're in New York about 2012, something like that. We're doing one of these city tours. And the tour guy goes, and a flat over there is where someone called Archibald Leach lived. Do anyone know who he is? Do you remember who he is? So I put my hands up. Yeah, Archibald Leach. He designed all these football stadiums, didn't he? Yeah, he designed the ice court, Everson. He designed the Everson. And I went on for 5 minutes. See, Evan, the coach, looking around. I was like, who's this loon here? And the answer was, no, I don't mean who you're talking about. I mean, Archibald Leach became Cary Grant, the film star. That's what I'm referring to here. And at which point, I was waiting for security to come and escort me off the bus. But I think she saw the funny side of it.
Yeah, what football stadiums did Cary Grant design?
Eh? Exactly.
I mean, that story about the boy's pen, and football was kind of raw in tooth and claw, wasn't it, back then? I mean, you know, I suppose it contributed to the atmosphere. I suppose it also contributed to the danger as well, I suppose.
Yeah, very much so, Dave. I mean, looking back, it was just simply brutal on every level. I mean, I was like 6 or 7 first time I went in the boy's pen, which I've referenced before. I remember seeing the sign on the entrance saying you had to be under the age of 16 to gain admissions. And I was looking behind this guy there, like with a beard, another guy there smoking away in his fags. Most people behind me seemed about 6'1", 6'2", or like a leather jacket, and looking like the type of people you didn't want to fall out with particularly. So that gave me an inkling of what to expect. And we kind of clambered up the stairs. The boys' pen was in the left-hand side of Goodison Park, upper section towards the Buttons Road stand, had railings in front of it to stop people getting out. But one of the regular sports was that young kids would get down to the front, try to climb over the railing, and they got to the top, they perched down and jump into the Gladys Street to be greeted with rounds of applause when people just hit them before the police would come in and remove them. But yeah, for me, it was a terrifying experience because I think we walked in, someone grabbed me, got any money, lads? Well, yeah, well, I've got some. And so for I knew, my pockets were being empty, my pocket money had disappeared, my sweets got taken off me. And then I saw some girls in the corner. I thought, oh, I'll go and stand by the girls. They're surely they're going to be all right. They were actually on a different level to most of the males there. So they started kicking me, pulling me, screaming at me. And by this stage, and the worst thing I could do was start crying, but I couldn't help it. And that just singled me out, you know, for more. And I just looked at my friend Alan and said, can we get out of here, please? I don't want to stay here anymore. And the two of us kind of clambered out and stood outside the stage. But yeah, the boys' pen was you know, as the name implies, you know, females weren't really expected at football games at that time. And you can imagine now in a new stadium, Corning, and they did the pen, you know, like the shed or something like that. It just wouldn't happen anymore, would it? But yeah, I mean, the boys' pen stayed in place at Goodison Park until about the 1977-78 season. And by that time, there'd been a few changes to it in that. I mentioned the railings the kids used to climb over. In the end, they caged that in. So how many health and safety regulations that breached? No idea. But it meant that one journey couldn't get out. And the reason why they did that was one of the activities that people used to do, there's a water tap at the back of the boys' pen where you can go to get a drink. I don't know if you remember, Dave, it used to be like an orange drink called Jubilee, but it was like a triangular shape, and you'd suck on it and suck on it until all the juice went out. Well, they were hugely popular. People would be tasting it in the boys' pen, but once they were empty, they'd go back to the tap, fill up with water, and then just throw them into the Gladys's end. So people were getting drenched by all these projectiles coming over the fences. So yeah, it was quite a horrific experience. So that was another reason why the K's are in. And in the end, the only reason why the club actually got rid of the boys' pen was because there was some kind of new health and safety directive from the government about number of access points in the stadium. And Everton didn't have enough access points on the Gladys Street terraces, which meant the capacity is going to be reduced from 50,000 to 37,000 or something like that. And the first game of the season was against Nottingham Forest, and the club were kind of desperately trying to find a way around this. And then they hit upon there, they go, hang on, if we close the boys' pen, that creates other exit points. And because they did that, the boys' pen disappeared. The capacity was increased back to its original level, but it meant a piece of football history had just completely disappeared and been wiped away.
You started going in the 60s, which wasn't a bad time to start going and watching Everton, Harry Kattrick's teams and league championships and all of that, and being stuck in there with 50-odd thousand people week after week. I mean, that must have been some experience seeing, you know, the Holy Trinity and Joe Royle and the Golden Vision and all of that. That must have been fantastic years.
Yeah, I think when you're young, you kind of take that for granted a bit. You kind of think it's going to be like this every year. You know, you're going to win the league title every year. You're going to be seeing these great players every year. And of course, at that time, you know, Everton were kind of known as the Mersey Millionaires because they were spending big transfer fees out to bring top quality players to the club. And yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, looking back, having the privilege of watching, you know, Howard Kendall, Colin Harvey, Alan Ball, you know, the Holy Trinity operating at their best, you know, was just an absolute pleasure and a privilege to watch that. And it's compared to now, the difference in going to home games, fully expecting an Everton win, fully expecting a good display, and even if you lost, fully expecting it to be a narrow defeat because, you know, a controversial referee, and this is not all something along those lines. So yeah, but I think for me, the big difference is when you get to, like, I think like most people, you first start going to the match with your parents. It's not always your dad's one, your mum takes you, or you, even grandparents in some cases. And that, as you get into about 8 or 9 or 10, you start to want to be going by yourself with your own friends. So when you're about 12 or 13, you tend not, I'd go towards the ground with my dad, but I'd meet my friends outside the ground and go to watch the match with them. And the good thing then was, like, you know, all your friends from school, but about 8 or 9 of you could all go together. You didn't need to be a part of the membership scheme. You didn't need to accumulate points or vouchers from home games you've been to. You didn't need any ID. You didn't need a credit card check. You turned up with your cash. You went through the turnstile, but you could stand with your friends all the way through the game, which to me is one of the things that really quite frustrates me about modern football, because I look at the modern stadium now and I think, I don't know what the average age of a Premier League fan is, but it must be 40 plus for some clubs, I would have thought. Whereas then, it was a very young audience. You know, yeah. There were loads of people under the age of 25 it's the baby boomer generation, so there were loads of us all young and wanted to go and watch football matches. And I just think a modern youngster watching Premier League football who has to sit in the same seats every week, surrounded by the same people every week, as opposed to sit with the friends, it's really lost something. And I think I'd also make the case, maybe that's why there's been a kind of bit of a resurgence in non-league football at the moment, because youngsters are finding they can go to watch their local non-league team, stand with their friends during the game, and almost have the similar experience now to what I was having in the 60s and 70s.
Being on the terraces and Gladys Street End and whatever, and watching Everton in full cry, and now being part of that surge as the whole, 15,000 of you all fell forward at one point and went back. And I mean, you look at it now on the footage, you must have been mental to be in there. but I mean, at the time, it was just such a thrilling thing to be a part of, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was, and you really felt as though you were kind of making, you know, your effort to get the team over the line as well with the support. But it's like, I guess it's like most things in life, is it, Dave? You kind of adapted to it. You just knew when to move forward. You knew when to move back. You anticipated when the surge is going to come. So you just you just rode the waves of the serves and the toing and throwing. And as you got a little bit older, you're able to fend for yourself a bit more. So if you, you know, if you were in that position, you'd knock yourself back into position. But yeah, it was quite a life skill because, you know, quite frankly, you know, if you hadn't anticipated those surges, then you'd be ending up on the floor with people champing all over you. So you had to adapt pretty quickly to make sure you were safe. But you just couldn't beat the fun, the joy of those surges, you know, particularly after you score, when everyone's jumping around, surging forward, dancing around the place. It was just an experience like no other. And it's not quite the same celebration in the stands because you haven't quite got the same proximity to people. Worse than the terraces, you're crammed right next to people as well. So yeah, it's an experience that's sadly being lost to the modern world in many ways.
Like most of us, you start out by standing up, as you said, at games for the most part when you're a teenager or whatever. I mean, where were you in the stadium then, and where did you move around to over the years?
Yeah, I think over the years I've probably stood in all. I've stood or sat in every part of the stadium. So, yeah, first experience, the first time my dad taught me was in the upper bowl and stands. Then most of the time I spent on the Gladys Street terraces. Occasionally, we go in the stand above the Gladys Street terraces as well. My dad would get his tickets there. And for the park stand at the opposite end. I think when I was a teenager, I was having kind of my first romances and things like that. I was ever taking the girls watching the Everton game. We'd always stand at the paddock by the main stand rather than subjecting them to the Gladys Street end. And then once the kind of the old CESA stadium became a thing from 1992 onwards, we kind of tried different parts of the stadium just to find the place that kind of suits us all best. So I probably sat in all four of the CESA areas of the stadium as well. For the 66 World Cup, I was in the Gladys Street Terrace for all those games also.
You mentioned the 66 World Cup, so we might as well come to that next. I mean, having the World Cup come to your football ground, and Pele being one of the players that was coming, I mean, my God, that's the definition of football heaven at the age of about, what, 12, 13, whatever it was.
Yeah, I was 10 at the time, Dave, and yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where I had no idea I'd be going to watch the World Cup at Goodison. I just assumed my dad and all his friends would be going. And I just remember about 2 weeks before the competition started, I woke up one morning and on the bedside table was an envelope. And I opened it, and in there were like five tickets for all the games through to the semi-final stage. So I was absolutely thrilled and delighted. And yeah, and we talked before, hadn't we, about, you know, seeing things in colour. The sight of walking down the Gladys Street before the Brazil-Bulgaria game and all these young Brazilian fans with their tan skin, you know, they just looked, compared to like monochrome Liverpool at the time, they just put this whole vibe of colour to the city. And you know, they all wore replica shirts. Now, of course, trying to get replica shirts in the mid-60s was well nigh impossible. You know, I think most Everton supporters would just buy a plain blue shirt and stick a badge onto it. You just couldn't. Clubs just didn't understand what that market was. Yeah, so it was the colour, and then of course the fact it's the noise, the samba beats of the drums, and they were all in the upper Gladys Street section for most of the games at Goodison Park as well. The thing that really caught my attention was listening to talk in Portuguese, because I'd never really heard people speak a foreign language before, and so listening to talk, engage with each other, I was just in awe. Wow, this is brilliant. And yeah, I mean, for the first game, I'm going up the steps towards the Gladys Street, and then I think, I'm going to see Pele and Garrincha play here at Goodison Park. Now, my life can't get any better than this. And of course, Pele scored a free kick for Brazil in the streets, and Garrincha scored a second free kick for Brazil in the Stanley Park end. It just came away thinking, you know, it was absolutely on every level. Now, actually, just sort of one of the best days of my life. And I've still got so many vivid memories of that World Cup at Goodison. The next game was Brazil against Hungary. Pele couldn't play because he was injured. And Hungary kind of upset the odds by beating Brazil 3-1 in what was a fantastic game of football. I remember at the end of the game, you know, Florian Albert had a superb display for Hungary. And at the end of the match in the Gladys Street end, everyone was just shouting, Albert, Albert, Albert. And the team had kind of left the pitch by that stage. And someone from the Hungarian delegation said, they're chanting your name up there. Get back out there. Get back out there. So he came back out with Benny, I think it was. And the two of them came over to the Gladys Street end and started walking around the stadium. And everyone was there cheering them, applauding them. So it was just a really unique experience. And then the third game, in some ways, was quite disappointing because, you know, as you know, Perry was kind of ruthlessly kicked out of the competition at that stage. But, you know, one player goes, another one takes his place. So though Perry was kicked out of the competition, suddenly had Eusebio to focus on instead, who scored two stunning goals in that game as well. And then suddenly the focus has shifted from, okay, Perry's gone now, but no, and that's really sad because I think Brazil would have played the quarterfinal Goodison as well. But suddenly we got Eusebio, so that was something special as well. And then, of course, you get to the quarterfinals, and it's still... It's probably in the top three of games of football I've ever seen in my life. So it's Porto and North Korea. No one's expecting North Korea to progress to that stage. Maybe getting a place up. Yeah, I think we were expecting like a Brazil-Italy quarterfinal. Instead, we got Porto and North Korea. And then I remember, you know, being on the glass seats, and within the first minute, North Korea score first. And the people come up, what's the score like? What's the score like? Korea with 1-0. Nah, what's the score? Tell us the score. Stop messing around. And I remember looking around thinking that it almost seemed like every person of audience or descent was in the Gladys Street End. It's like the whole Liverpool Chinatown community have come on to support Korea as well. And after 24 minutes, when they were 3-0, the noise was just incredible. The crowd chanted, we want four, we want four, and easy, easy. And the whole place was just mesmerised by what they'd seen, because the contrast, I mean, the North Koreans, they wore a white shirt. They were so thin and so small and so wiry. You had like 6'4" Torres playing for Portugal. He had like dwarfed over most of the Korean team, but they just bust everywhere. They were full of energy. And in the modern game, they would have just killed the game at 3-0. They'd have just like wasted time, brought players down, sat back. But they went for the fourth goal, possibly urged on by the crowd, because the crowd kept chanting to get a fourth goal. And then suddenly Eusebio kind of upped his game. And I think there's a great clip for one of the penalties where he's hacked down about three times and the defenders just bounce off him because he's so strong and powerful. But it was a superb comeback from Portugal. Obviously, we all want North Korea to win, so absolutely no question about that. But yeah, absolutely fantastic game of football. And I think looking back, I'd argue that Goodison Park had the best World Cup games, certainly better World Cup games than Wembley. And I think I'm privileged to say, like, I can look back and say I've seen play Goodison Park, the great Lev Yashin for Russia. I've seen Franz Beckenbauer play for West Germany. I've seen Garrincha and Pelé for Brazil. I've seen Eusebio for Portugal. And I've seen Pak Durek for North Korea. It's the whole spectrum of you know, footballing, at least at that time. And of course, not at Wembley got to see Pelé. Not only Wembley got to see Garrincha, and we got to see, you know, you say we played three times. I think Wembley got to see him twice in the end. So I think Goodison Park had the best crowd outside of Wembley for the World Cup as well. And unlike the early group games of Wembley, where I believe they had to give away free tickets to get people in to fill the capacity for certain of the games, every game at Goodison Park was kind of 50,000 plus.
One of the great things about Goodison Park is, I mean, we were talking before, I mean, my club, the Albion, you know, I've been going there for 50-odd years and we've changed everything. We're still on the same site, which is fantastic. But, you know, they've knocked stands down and et cetera, et cetera. Goodison's still kind of, apart from that bit behind the goal, it's obviously changed, but Goodison still looked a bit like Goodison did, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. When you go there, you must be able to just look and, oh, yeah, that was where Pelé was. That was where, yeah, that's a fantastic thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, when my son started coming to the matches with us, I'd point out things that I expect over there. I was standing there when Pelé scored a free kick for Brazil in 1966. You probably get sick of hearing these stories, you know. But, you know, it is, they've all been there. But, there's you know, so many memories about that. And it's not just the players. It's the memories of the people you went to the stadium with. So obviously got memories of my dad being there. No, my granddad used to go before him as well. And memories of lots of friends you kind of maybe don't see anymore. We think we always stand out in the corner over there. You know, I wonder where they are now. We kind of lost contact. So yeah, it's the players, it's the football, it's football and memories. But it's also the match day experience, maybe other people used to go to their matches with as well, because now it's been like you end up drifting apart. Some people, you know, in your 20s, you saw every day of the week. In your 50s, 60s, you don't kind of see them anymore. So there's all that as well. But there is something about, as you say there, Dave, about the ground not having changed that much, because it's just this kind of sense of like longevity, almost this sense of being part of a ritual, being part of something that's never changed over the years. I think the worst thing the club did was when they redesigned the Stanley Park stand, made the single tier because it just needed to be double tier. And I think a few of us still think now that that stand had been double tier, then maybe the move to new stadium might not have been such a necessity, given that would have increased the capacity considerably and give the club a lot more hospitality options and things like that. But yeah, it's like when you go to the Hawthorns, Dave, okay, I accept the layouts of the ground has changed, but it's still the ground, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's still the walls to the ground. It's still where you used to meet people. There's still the corners you used to stand. It's where the programme shop used to be. It's where the fish and chip shop used to be. It's where the pub used to be by the ground. It's all kind of these things that, even though the design of the stadium might have changed, the actual sense of the stadium is still there.
We talked about the World Cup, but we must talk about Everton. And I'll shut up for the next half. you can tell me all about the greatest players and the great games. You've had two or three fabulous sides over that period. So, I mean, the memories must just come falling out.
I don't really remember too much about the 62, 63 team. I was probably too young to take it all in. But 6-70 team, yeah. I mean, it was a... mentioned before about the Holy Trinity, about Harry Kendall, Colin Harvey, and Alan Ball. I mean, what a fabulous midfield trio that was. And when you think, looking back now, Kendall never won an England cap. Harvey won one England cap. It's just bizarre that, you know, given the excellent standards they delivered week in, week out, that they never got the international recognition both those players deserve. And then, of course, you had Joe Royal Funds, who at the time was like 19-20, and was scoring goals for fun. And then you had a rock-solid defence there with like Brian LeBeau and Roger Ken. You had Gordon West in goal, who's quite an underrated keeper, and who possibly, it could be a discussion point this, but I think he was originally scheduled to go to the World Cup in 1970. And if he had gone and maybe played instead of Peter Benetti, who knows how that West Germany game may or may not have turned out. It's one of these great what-if moments, isn't it? And of course, he had on the wings here, you had Jimmy Husband, who was a very dynamic winger as well. You had Johnny Morrissey on the left-hand side, who's one of the hardest players in football and who allegedly was in Jack Charlton's little black book, a few runners he had in the past. And then, you know, on the championship running, when the team seemed to be stumbling a little bit with Leeds kind of trying to rein them in, Alan Whistle suddenly breaks through to the team, scores about 11 goals in 14 games, and then we end up beating, sorry Dave, West Brom 2-0 on a Tuesday night to lift the title in 1970. So yeah, it's a fabulous memory, an absolutely brilliant team. You know, and crowds of 50,000 plus most weeks, up to 60,000 plus for the derby games, the majority of them all standing as well. So yeah, I mean, fabulous team, fabulous memories. And of course, I think the frustrating thing for Everton was that we were kind of being billed as the team of the 70s, and we had the manager, we had the money, we had the infrastructure, we had the players, and it just kind of all went badly wrong, mainly that the one week in 1971, when in the space of kind of 4 days, we lost to Panathinaikos in the quarterfinal of the European Cup, and we lost to Liverpool in the FA Cup semi-final, and it took the club a long time to recover from that. Having said that, I mean, there were highlights in the mid-70s, there was the... Under Billy Bingham, 74-75, they became very close to winning the title, except for losing twice to Carlisle United, which actually cost us. And then, Gordon Lee, at the time, was kind of undervalued for his achievements. But you look back now, he had two top four finishes, took us into Europe, took us to the League Cup final, took us a few FA Cup semi-finals as well. So they were good times as well. But then sometimes you have to suffer to go back to reach the heights again. And certainly... the mid eight, the two different versions of the mid 80s team, the 84-85 team, it's well renowned throughout the football world. I mean, what a glorious combination of players that was. In particular, you had the midfield there with Peter Reid and Paul Bracewell. Up front, you could pick from Andy Gray, Graham Sharp, or Adrian Heath, who all contributed in different ways. And on the wings there, Trevor Stephen and Kevin Sheedy with those free kicks. And then Neville Southall, who I'd argue with most people, probably the best goalkeeper I've seen in terms of his agility, his ability to pull off wonder saves. And then Pat Van Den Howe on the left side of defence, who really certainly took no prisoners at any level. Yeah, so they were a young team, a vibrant team, and sadly, the 84-85 team was denied the opportunity of participating in Europe because of the events of high school. I don't know, it's another great what-if moments of English football. What if that Everton team being allowed to play in the European Cup? What if they'd gone on to win it? It's kind of one of these things now that you look at No, the media's been dominated by Liverpool, ex-Liverpool players as pundits, certainly in the 90s, 2000s, 2010s, mainly because of the European successes. But turn the clock back, if Everton had those European successes, could you see a scenario whereby all the matchday pundits are Everton players who are talking about their experiences at the highest level winning European trophies and the like? And then, of course, the despite the European ban, you know, I think the big thing with 84-85 was people were worrying would it be a one-off like it was in 69-70, that having lost the double in 85-86, which I won't talk about anymore, it was good to come back in 86-87 with a different version of the 84-85 team, with people like Paul Power stepping up, Wayne Clark being brought in from Wolverhampton Wanderers, Ian Snowden coming in from Leeds United, Dave Watson coming in from Norwich City. So key players being brought in. So effectively half the 86-87 team hadn't played in 84-85. And fringe players like Adam Harper, who didn't play most in 84-85, played 30 games in 86-87. So that was another brilliant era for the team. And then you kind of think, you know, surely the European ban's got to end this summer. We've been out of Europe for 3 years now. Surely it's going to be rescinded for the first 86-87 team. But it wasn't. And so once again, we started losing players like Trevor Stephen, Gary Stephen to Glasgow Rangers. People left and we've never really got back to those heights. Obviously, the mid-1990s under Joe Royal was a special time, particularly some stunning derby victories at Goodison Park over Liverpool. Duncan Ferguson obviously became a bit of a cult hero then. We won the FA Cup in 1995. And sadly, since then, we've knocked on the door a few times, particularly under David Moyes' first tenure, and we qualified for the Champions League and probably got the hardest draw you could have been given in the qualifying sections. I think Liverpool got the new Saints and we got Villarreal. I'm not saying there's any sort of dubious practices going on there, but it did seem a bit strange, didn't it? And then, you know, as a club now, it's just hugely frustrating because, like yourself, David, West Brom, you know, with your history, with your tradition, with the trophies that you've won, all the things that make you, give you status of a football club, we kind of hankering to get back to those days. And there's massive discussions to be had about, you know, what's more important, you know, winning trophies or being part of a footballing tradition, being part of a footballing heritage, being part of a footballing society. And you know, certainly at the moment, you know, I think one of the things I'm quite proud of is Everton's long proud tradition of being the oldest team in the city, founded in 1878. And the fact that, you know, I think you've written a book about Danny Blanchard, haven't you, Dave?
I have.
And his quote, "The game's about glory." I love that quote because it's not always about winning. It's about the glory of being part of your team. It's about the glory of your history. It's about the glory of your tradition. And you can't, you know, West Brom, like ourselves, found the members of the Football League. You can't replace that sort of history or tradition that a club has, and that can never be taken away from any of those 12 founding members of the Football League.
That's the thing about having a ground as well for such a long period of time. I don't quite know how it happens, but those players seep into the concrete. You go to Goodison Park, and I mean, not even we can remember it, but you can feel Dixie Dean somehow.
His ashes are under the centre circle, Dave.
Well, there you are. But you know, you can feel those sort of great deeds from the past, you know, whichever club it is and whichever players it is, and yeah. That's another feature of Goodison, because so many fantastic players have been there through the years.
Yeah, and we've all got our favourite players from the different generations, haven't we? So certainly, you know, when I was in the 69-70 team, Alan Ball would be up there with my favourite all-time Everton player, you know, for the dynamism he brought to the team, for the leadership he showed, his goals, his contributions, his never-say-die attitudes, certainly up there, you know, if I was picking an all-time Everton team. Then you look to the team in the 70s and the likes of Bob Latchford with his phenomenal goal scoring record. Also Andy King, who was a very, very talented footballer, sadly no longer with us. And then you go to the 80s, so many players you can pick from there. I think I mentioned a few, Neville Southall, Graham Sharp, Andy Gray, Adrian Heath, Trevor Steve, all of that team. And then even to the 90s, you know, you've got the likes of Duncan Ferguson as well, into the Premier League era. Tim Cahill is another one who stands out for his contribution to the team as well. So, and then, of course, you know, Wayne Rooney, who I saw scoring as a 16-year-old against Arsenal when he came on as a substitute as well. So, yeah, there's all those ghosts of footballers past. And, I mean, probably like you, Dave, I also like to imagine that I'd seen certain players before I was born that were playing there. So, you know, would have loved to have seen Dixie Dean play. That would have been an absolute memory to treasure. I was always quite jealous of my dad because he's seen Dixie Dean play, as my father-in-law had as well. So there's all those kind of players in the past as well. And I don't know what the situation is at West Brom, but one of the things with Goodison Park is until probably like the 1990s, you know, fans would often have their ashes buried on the perimeter of the football pitch. So there's that kind of sense of, you know, not going all religious, it's kind of like, you know, it's like a church, a place of worship. And you're there standing, sitting at a stadium where you know the ashes of people who support the team for X number of years are actually there on the pitch watching things as well.
I suppose the sadness is that great stadiums, it's also become part of the reason why Everton couldn't necessarily keep up in the Premier League era. As you say, the stand wasn't developed to be big enough. And, you know, Premier League football, you need to have 60,000 people in the stadium if you're going to compete with Arsenal, Manchester United, and Liverpool and all of that. And, you know, I suppose in that sense, it became inevitable that this was going to happen.
Yeah, sadly, yeah, Dave. And I think as well, it's the lack of hospitality facilities because more and more these days that the club are desperate for the hospitality market. I think one of the things Everton is quite pride themselves on at the moment is, for example, when James Kwiatkowski scored the stoppage time equaliser against Liverpool in the last Merseyside derby, you can see the scenes of celebration. And then you don't see anyone there with like their mobile phones trying to film it or, you know, doing selfies in the background. Everyone's there, part of the action, everyone's there celebrating, and it just frustrates me the number of times I watch games these days, and there's people there filming the whole match, there's people there filming the opposition scoring as though that's part of the experience. I just really can't get my head around that. Yeah, I think Everton quite prides on the fact that most of the supporters, you know, if they don't actually live in Merseyside, have a connection to Merseyside, and provide the families who moved away from the city but have still kept the Everton affection going there, you know, through their kids who come back to watch them regularly. So I think, you know, that's quite a unique part of the Everton club culture as well. And I think also it's there's kind of a pride in the fan base being mainly local. And I think one of the big worries is that with the new stadium, are we going to lose that? Is it going to be more hospitality based? Are we going to be like other Premier League clubs where the legacy fan isn't quite made as welcome as what they once were? Is it going to be the case they're trying to attract, you know, the weekend football tourists who buys out the souvenir shop, spends a fortune at the club on food and refreshments, never criticise the club, never criticise the board, they're never there once a year? It'd be a real shame if that was the case with the new stage, but hopefully it's not going to be that way. I think the club has done quite well with the pricing policy and keeping it, you know, accessible, affordable for most of the fan base, but sadly, in the modern era, as you say, Dave, you know, hospitality rules, you need to be generating this level of income if you want to get anywhere near competing in European competition. And sadly, if you're not playing in Europe at the moment, then you're almost off the radar in terms of lots of footballing fans whose diet is watching the Premier League on the TV rather than actually experiencing it as a real living visceral moments, you know, being there and taking in the game, saving the action, being part of the crowd. It's something you cannot recreate at home.
We'll come back to Goodison in a sec, but I mean, you know, you've mentioned the new stadium. I know you've been to a couple of games there to see what's what and how it's going to set up. I mean, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I've been to two test events. So the first one qualified on the ballot. The second one of my friends couldn't go, so he gave me his ticket. Quite contrasting with it. The first one, it was a cold, dark February night. It was absolutely freezing down by the new stadium. The limited facilities, there was nothing outside the ground. So apart from the excitement of actually getting into the stadium, it just seemed a little bit underwhelming. It was far better the second test event because it was in daylight. There were a lot more facilities outside. The plaza in the front of the stadium was being used. There were lots of displays, people milling around, and there were 20,000 in the stadium, which had far more of a better atmosphere. It's hard to anticipate what it's going to be like, really. You mentioned before about the Lego stadiums, Dave. So it's not a Lego stadium. It's designed as a football stadium. It's not like an Etihad or a London stadium that where athletic stadiums originally have been repurposed as a football stadium. It feels like a football stadium. The South Stand, which is kind of the the new Gladys, to some extent, has been designed like Borussia Dortmund's The Wall. So it's just really steep, really banked right up. But the good thing about the stadium is the seats are right close to the pitch. So you're still feeling part of this. So there's still that intensity there. And I think we're really hoping that with the level of noise that will be generated, it might, to some extent, recreate the ferocity that you get at Goodison Park at certain games, because certainly the club's going to need that level of ferocity. They've got to turn the stadium into an absolute bear pit. It's got to be full of venom and vitriol. You know, teams have got to be, you know, really don't want to play there because they know how horrible it's going to be. And that's got to be part of the new stadium. So no matter how the fan base might change, that part has to change, because that is certainly something that's got the club over the line, certainly in the last few seasons in particular. But yeah, I mean, there's not a bad view in the stadium. The seats are all fantastic. Whether you're up at the top or whether you're down to the front, you get a brilliant vantage point anywhere. The safe standing area behind the goal looks really good as well. I'm a big fan of safe standing. It's a really good idea for modern stadiums. And the facilities are, you know, you kind of get used to how poor the facilities are at Goodison Park. It's just part of the experience, sadly. But I think one of the things that will be lost with the new stadium is, because of the way the priorities were allocated for when you could get your ticket, it means a lot of people who sat together in the same area of the stands at Goodison Park for a number of years are going to lose that continuity, because they've got the season tickets at different times and they qualified for different periods. So people being used to, like, so kind of where we sit now in the Upper Bullens, the whole row of us have all been together for like 10, 12 years. We're all going to be in different parts of new stage now, which is quite sad. Obviously, you make new acquaintances, you make new friends, but it's sad to lose that continuity as well. As you know yourself from watching, you know, West Brom day, if you walk, you know, you find your seat, you know everybody around you, you say hello. It's just part of the match day experience. And it will take a while to recreate that in its new form in the stadium.
They've been talking about the move for a few years now, and it's been on off as to when it was actually going to happen. And then, of course, this season we knew it was going to be the last. I mean, what have the emotions been like this season? I mean, it must have been a very, very odd kind of year.
It's been funny, Dave, because I think it didn't really hit home until about January, February time. I think probably hit home more after the first test event, because then suddenly people realised, you know what, this is actually happening now. And I think you've kind of seen this as the season being drawn to a close, that there's been more and more of a sense of, you know, we've really got to make the most of this. That this is, you know, we've only got three games to go, only got four games to go. So, for example, like at the game yesterday, yesterday almost felt like the actual last game of the season, because it was Saturday, it was 3 o'clock, it was a bank holiday weekend, it was a very sunny day, and I've never seen the area around Goodison Park so crowded. We walked around the stadium before the start of the game, and it was absolutely packed. All the pubs nearby, you know, they were totally full, and there were lots of people there yesterday, I think, who had been given a ticket by a friend or a family member to experience Goodison for one last time. So it was quite a unique atmosphere there. I know some of my friends gave tickets to their brothers and people who didn't have a season ticket this year to make sure that they could get the Goodison experience. So yesterday actually felt like, to me, it was the last game of the season, because it was Saturday 3 o'clock. And to me, if you're leaving the stadium, then leave it on Saturday 3 o'clock. So I'm quite frustrated that we've been shoved to the 12 o'clock slot to play Southampton for our last game. To me, that's just wrong on every level. You know, it's just, you know, it just shows the TV executives have no idea about what tradition means to the fans of a club. It's just not going to be the same. And I think on Saturday as well, most people were using it as a chance to have a drink before the game, because although the pubs of Panay are going to be open at 6 o'clock in the morning on the Sunday, the last game, I'm not going to be in the pub at 6 in the morning. Absolutely no chance. But I think people are used as, people yesterday wanted to savour the ritual, so they went to one or two of the pubs near the stadium, had a walk around the stadium, and you're not going to get that at 12 o'clock. So, yeah, it's just fascinating. I think there's still an element to the family. So before, who thinks we're not going to move there, we're going to be at Goodison Park anyway. But it's really sad. It's really sad to hit home now, and it's going to take a massive readjustment on every sort of level, in terms of your match day routine, in terms of, you know, where you go before the game, in terms of your walk to the stadium, in terms of the shops you call in, the pubs you visit, all that sort of thing is all going to be completely upended. So it's going to be hard to adjust to. And We're still unsure what the long-term plans are for Goodison Park. There are kind of some discussions possibly about the women's team being based there, which if that was the case, that would be brilliant. So maybe keeping one or two of the stands still in place there, because where the ground is, if you sell it off the property, you're not really going to make that much money particularly, because so I think if they keep it as kind of some sort of, you know, as a base for the women's football team, I think that would be excellent. And it would just be really good, I think, if over the summer period, you know, there were a few more like open days and events to give people that chance to go there, because I know a number of people, for various reasons, not being able to get to the stadium this season. And it's a missed opportunity for the club as well to grant more access to people who would like to experience one last look in the stadium. The club are giving season ticket holders the chance to buy their seats for £90 each. I mean, one would have thought if you're a season ticket holder, can't you have your seat for nothing? Well, honestly, 2 weeks today, Dave, no, the number of fans are going to be turning with those screwdrivers. It's going to be quite interesting. And people got all sorts of plans for how they're going to whisk the chair on the stage. How many make it successfully, I'm not quite sure. But yeah, it's going to be a really sad day. And you know, I don't think it will hit home until the first home game of the season at the new stadium. Yeah, so I mean, I think my kind of thoughts on all would be that, you know, although I think my body would be in the new stadium, but my heart would always be at Goodison Park. If that kind of makes sense.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it would be perfect. It's like if they did keep the stadium going so that people can go back. You know, I mean, for the women's team, it would be an added attraction to get people in to watch the women's team as well, for them to be playing at Goodison in this, you know, cathedral of football. I mean, yeah, they are all cathedrals, whether it's Goodison, whether it's Old Trafford, whether it's the Hawthorns, Molyneux, Anfield, whatever. These are the places where we've built this country's game. It doesn't matter how much better the new facilities are, and I understand why we moved to new grounds, but you cannot change. I mean, how long have we had Wembley now? 20 years? It's not Wembley, is it?
It's not a bit like the old Wembley, is it, Dave? Not at all.
Yeah, and it won't be until me and you have gone, and you know, people who were our age in the 60s and 70s have had 40 years of experience of seeing games at Wembley. Yeah, that's how it is, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I think each new stadium has to build its own tradition, doesn't it? You know, and it will do, because as the younger generation of fans come through, their memories are all going to be associated with the new stadium. So when they are eyes, that's what they're going to look back upon. But yeah, there's really something about, you know, the first professional football league was in England, you know, the 1888, then the idea with William McGregor starting the football league competition together. You know, that's nearly over 140 years ago since that league first started. So yeah, I mean, you feel as though, I think in particular, you know, like you with West Brom, like us at Everton, if you're there watching a team who's been a founder member of the football league, there's just this sense of continuity that you were there at the beginning, you were there when it first started. You didn't just jump on the bandwagon a few seasons later. You were actually there at the start. You were the innovators. You were the first teams in the city, and that's something that can never be taken away. Yeah, there is just something about the tradition, the sense. It's almost like a sense of eternity with the stadiums. The fact the memories of those stadiums will live on long after the stadiums themselves have departed, and we will pass down those stories of the stadium to the next generation of people coming through. And I think it's really important that those stories are passed down. And you know, it's you look now, you can find clips of every football game, every football club over, you know, most seasons since the Premier League started. But you know, you just wish a few more clips of the 1920s, the 1930s, the 1940s. So you just look back and just think, wow, you know, look at those crowds, look at those players. There's Dixie Dean there. There's Albert Gelhardt there. There's Ted Sagan and goal. It's all these players. Just wish, you know, if I'd been born earlier, I maybe I've got to see these players. And it's just being part of the football family, being part of football tradition, and you know, being part of something that's meant so much to so many people's lives.
The simple truth is Goodison Park will never see the like again, will it?
No, absolutely not, Dave. I think there's a mistake in assuming that the new stadium is going to be a Goodison Park too. It's not. It has to build its own history. It has to build its own tradition. It has to create its own footballing memories. So, you know, we leave Goodison Park with so many memories, you know, good and bad, which is part of the sport and the football team. You know, there are some seasons I really would want to revisit. There are others I'd love to put the pause button on and save every second of them. And that's the thing, you know, I would find it really hard, you know, to be, I know it seems strange for me to say this, but in some ways, I would like to be like Man City, win the league 6 seasons out of 7, because where's the fun on that? Where's the challenge? Where's the joy in, before the season starts, you're probably going to win it anyway. The thing about football is it should be hard. There should be adversity. You should have to overcome difficulty. You should upset the odds. And it's just, when we do the 60s decades podcast, the number of different teams that won the football league in the 1960s, I'd love to get back to an era like that where every team of the first game of the season, no matter who you support, whether it's Ipswich Town, Tottenham, West Brom, Everton, as a fan, you felt, we've got a chance to win the league this season. Whereas now you don't. I never look at the start and think we're going to win the league this season, because I know we're not.
Yes, it's a sad old thing. But well, I hope the final game against Southampton is everything that you wanted to be. I don't know what that is. I don't imagine you know what that is.
I have a nightmare scenario with this day, because Southampton have beaten us twice this season already. So I just see Southampton pulling off treble, because they beat us the goodest in the League Cup earlier in the season as well. I'll be honest with you, I think the game won't actually matter. I think the game is just going to pass people by. I can see a lot of the game people getting out of the seats, going down, taking photographs. And, you know, I think the game's going to be like a distraction. I think it'd be more interesting to see how the club will commemorate the game in terms of the kind of fan displays, because the fan displays last year home games from the 1878 have been absolutely superb. I really have created such brilliant memories for the fan base. So it'd be interesting what the club does there as well. We've still no idea what the post-match plans are. Will there be a parade of ex-players? Will there be something going on? Will we be allowed to stay in the stadium? Will we be allowed to link? There's a real lack of clarity here, because, you know, I know some, if the gates open at 10 o'clock, I think people will be queuing to get in at 10 o'clock. I think when the game finishes at 2, no one's going to want to go home. People will want to stay and enjoy and take it all in, you know, for the last time. So it's going to be really, really strange, Dave. I really don't know how I'm going to react until that moment when I walk down the steps, I leave the stage, think, I'm never coming here again. It's just going to be absolutely bizarre.
It is. Well, it is the end of an era. I hope we've done Goodison proud for an hour or so anyway. So thanks again, Paul, for giving us all your memories. I hope you've all enjoyed that. And we'll be back with the Lob Podcast, These Football Times, again soon.
And Dave, thanks so much for inviting me on to share my goodness and memories. I hope I haven't bored you silly during the course of my reminiscing. And thanks you for all the questions as well, and give me the chance to go back and experience and recreate and recount and retell some of the best years of my life as a football fan, and also to allow me to skip over some of the worst years as well, which I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. QZ cars.